This is an oral history with Tucker Collins on 4th of March 1991 with Arnold Thackeray and Francis Kohler. Tucker, could you begin by telling us a little bit about where you were born and the family you were born into?
I was the first child born in Moraine, Ohio, which is on the west side of Cleveland, known for steel mills and burning rivers, actually, to an interesting woman and a chemical engineer. My father grew up in New York, in the city area, reasonably affluent family, went to MIT and took a job with B.F. Goodrich, kind of doing chemical stuff, which brought him to a plant, Avon Lake. My mother was much less fortunate. She was in the middle ranks of a guy who died in his 40s, very young, in Akron, Ohio. She went on full scholarship to Smith, was a very smart woman, and was working as a chemist with B.F. Goodrich, going to law school part-time at night at Case when she met my father. She's a very smart lady. I think nowadays she would have been a full-time person throughout her life. She took time off to take care of us. I'm not sure whether she actually lived up to all of her potential. Anyway, I was in Lorraine for a year, then in basically a bedroom community, also on the west side of Cleveland called Avon Lake, for a couple of years, and then another community in Cleveland where I started school. That community is called Bay Village. Those of you that know Cleveland know that the east side is the place to be. Shaker Heights, Cleveland Heights, University Heights. This is the west side, which is, I don't think, nearly as interesting. Okay, from there, fourth grade, went to New Jersey. My father worked in and out of New York City, and at this point my mother was doing nothing but being a full-time housewife. Just parenthetically, let me note that she was a full-time housewife basically from about the time I was small to about the time my brother went to college, at which point she went back into banking. She retired as a bank vice president and running a probate department. So this was Summit, New Jersey, which is another bedroom community, basically for New York, known to some because it houses a big pharmaceutical, and it's nearby Bell Labs. What can I tell you there? I was not the friendliest of people. I'm still not the friendliest of people. My grandparents had a place out on Long Island. If you know Long Island at all, it's Nassau County, Suffolk County. Nassau is where the burbs of New York are. Suffolk's some of the nice places. Long Island splits into two parts, and they had a summer place. So I spent most of my summers while we were in New Jersey learning how to sail, and have been kind of a lifelong sailor. Anyway, we went back and forth there, summers on Long Island, back to New Jersey for 4 or 5 years, and then went back to Cleveland, where I graduated from high school. I would say the thing most important in terms of scientific development was the attendance as a junior in a program called the Program in Biochemistry, or PIB as we call it. This was an NSF-sponsored program back when the NSF had funding, which basically allowed high school students to study what we would call molecular biology now, what was called biochemistry at that point. It's an interesting story, actually. I remember my father was basically a basketball fan. Being my size, you really have to play, and he wanted nothing but to have me play basketball. And my mother basically was the one who thought this was a great idea. I was very interested in science. I should do this. And big fight. And anyway, she won, like most women, eventually gets her way. It's a good thing. I certainly remember her fondly for that, because I had a great opportunity. And interesting, you have in this program a number of people that have benefited from that. Peter Arvon, for example, as well as a new first-year person, Stuart Schumann. We met them 20 years ago in this program.
All three of you?
All three of us, at least. In the same group at the same time, yes.
This was geographically?
This is the same program. The way the program ran was actually very interesting. They solicited juniors going to be seniors in high school, and basically took Leninger at the time, was a standard college textbook of biochemistry, and crammed it into 6 weeks. There were assistant, or what they were called advanced students, and instructors. Instructors were from the various colleges in the Northeast, which is great because you got a chance to chit-chat with some of the folks from different institutions. Advanced students were seniors going into college. And the program was basically didactic sessions in the morning followed by afternoon experimental laboratories. And you essentially were enrolled in a research environment. I basically have been doing science since I was 15, 16, something like that. And certainly by the time I went to this high school program, we were well enmeshed in what I would consider now to be postgraduate level research. Anyway, yes, there are a number of people. I know Peter Arvon was there, and I know Stuart Schumann was there because I taught both of them, actually, or was involved with them. It would be interesting to check the files of the Pew against the files of the people that played through this program. But it was a tremendous opportunity to experience different people from different institutions. The director of the program was from Amherst College, and two of the instructors were from Amherst College. And based on our associations, that was the thing that led me to that particular choice of college. There are a number of people from Princeton and from MIT, and I just wasn't happy with the kind of general education that I was sensing from them, believe it or not. Anyway, they taught you biochemistry in 6 weeks. I graduated from high school, basically after dropping out of the program and alienating the hell out of my father. And they moved again. They moved to Ann Arbor. So I basically have not been back to Cleveland, actually, since I left to go to college. Did go to Amherst College, and was interested in English and in basically biochemistry or molecular biology, genetics. Amherst is a reasonably liberal arts education. You couldn't focus on one of those things. It was just kind of generic biology. The subsequent 4 years, I would say, I developed an interest in gainful employment, so decided to go to medical school instead of graduate school, essentially to increase salary, still being a scientist for the most part.
Can I take you back to your first interest in science? You said 15 or something.
Well, that was the first time I really decided to try and establish professional training. I had been interested for a long time. I was alienated by religion very early on, and was interested in prebiotic synthesis mechanisms and organic chemists. Until I went to Amherst, I was interested in being an organic chemist, essentially. So I remember trying to read chemistry books very early on, fourth grade, fifth grade. A lot of my relatives had leftover textbooks from one thing or another, and I ended up with most of them and was rummaging around and kind of leafing through them. And because I lived in so many places, I just kind of said to hell with everyone and spent a great deal of time looking at that kind of stuff. In fact, I should have mentioned, the senior year, I was interested in a particular research in high school, a particular research project, and submitted it to the Westinghouse people. And the Westinghouse chose the project as what they call a national Westinghouse scientist thing, whatever they award. So there were 18,000 or so people, and they chose a bunch of intermediate finalists and 40 national finalists, and we went to Washington for a week. And we competed for scholarships, which probably rightly so, I didn't receive one. It's interesting to see how the people in that top 10 group did. Two of them were dead, interestingly enough, by suicides. Lots of mathematician people. The people in biology are still around, but our junior faculty in various institutions. But it was very interesting because I was the first person from the west side of Cleveland ever to win this. They were astounded. The east side was absolutely flabbergasted.
Was your school? They were good at describing a lot of internal motivation, but was your school? Was your mother or what?
No, they really weren't very helpful, to be honest. This was the west side of Cleveland. Basically, is kind of Big Ten. in its mentality. It is a intellectual desert, basically. You have to have a lot of self-motivation to survive. Most of the people I know never got out of the Midwest. They may have moved on, but they never survived. And certainly I'm the only one left in major academics.
Well, you must have got a pretty big boost out of winning that thing, didn't you?
Well, it was basically a blow to my father, because he said you should be playing basketball, and basically you're out of your mind to do this. There's no chance in hell you're ever going to win it. It was great in terms of college applications, because the only place that turned me down was the Naval Academy, interestingly enough. As I told you, another theme in my life is I was a sailor. I wanted to be a line officer. And I probably would have been in the Middle East, but I wanted my own ship. And they said, A, you're too tall, you hit your head on the bulkhead. B, you can't see, so we can't put you on an airplane. But I could have gone anywhere else. In a sense, it's quite fortuitous that Amherst was interested. Once you win something like that, that basically every place wants you. It's a question of how much money they're going to give you.
Can you fill in a little bit about your brother and sister?
My sister
didn't go this route.
No. We are a very diverse family, actually. The politics is really not particularly good at all. My sister is the women's tennis coach at the University of Pennsylvania, but is crippled by a debilitating disease, unfortunately. It's called scleroderma. I don't know whether you're familiar with it. It's an autoimmune connective tissue disorder, basically, that reduces, affects the respiratory system, the GI system, and is potentially quite debilitating. Anyway, she's a great tennis player. Most of my family is good to world-class athletes. Many of my members of the family have played at Forest Hills for tennis. They're really good tennis players. We used to, back when the U.S. Open was held at, not in Flushing, but in the old tennis stadium in Queens, they all played there. They were, never got very far in the tournament, but basically were good enough to get in. She probably could have been if she wasn't so damn debilitated by this disease. Anyway, what can I tell you about her? She went to Rollins College in Florida on a tennis scholarship. What else is interesting? She's married to a guy in Philadelphia who is a nice guy. She had one child. Shortly after the birth of her child, one of the things, complications of scleroderma or autoimmune disorder, she lost her kidney function. And we were all typed for renal transplants, and my father and I were, I'm mismatched at both haplotypes. My father gave her a kidney, and a year and a half later, unfortunately, he died of another incredibly awful disease called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. He was 59, actually. He was a guy who could beat me in tennis 2 years before his death. He was in excellent shape, and basically because of a chronic aggressive disorder that we really don't understand, lost voluntary function of all his musculature, was eventually reduced to sitting in a chair, unable to move, and died of pneumonia at home.
What is your brother who's the...
Okay, he was born in 1960, so he's 8 years younger, and we were just out of sync. In a sense, we moved so many times, we share nothing in terms of background. He graduated from high school in Michigan, went to a college in Ohio, and is now doing environmental engineering. Did an undergraduate degree in geology and is now interested in sort of pollution control. He's a fairly normal guy. Has one kid. Lives outside Boston.
Go back to Amherst, if we may.
All right.
You're coming in with Westinghouse. So.
Well, I was very lucky. The Westinghouse was quite remarkable. Amherst College is an amazing place. There are a number of very, very smart people there. And I would put my... In terms of Amherst College, I didn't come from a prep school. I certainly did not have the level of sophistication that about half the class had. And it was certainly an aggressive place. I would say I was at best average. But it was a good experience. I think the people there are spectacular in terms of their breadth, their depth of interest, their writing skills. The quality of education is superb, and I certainly didn't take advantage of everything, both because of a focus toward what it turned out to be an eventual pre-medical interest, as well as my own cognitive function. There's still a limit to how much you can handle, because they will keep you very busy. Anyway, it's a great place, certainly excellent. I wish the English department had taken me. It was a very interesting story. You have to apply to the English department. And my application, I remember the interview you had as a very prestigious professor called Benjamin Lamont, who was a Shakespeare scholar. And he won't remember me at all, but he kind of picks up the essay and he kind of looks down, leaves through it, and then looks up at me. And his first comment was, "Mr. Collins, is there anything else you can do?" Mr. Collins, on a good day, you'd be a mediocre journalist. So I knew my route to medical school was short, and my abilities to generate creative literature would be limited to papers. So anyway,
did the science keep up? Well,
Amherst has the ability to fluctuate depending on the faculty members who were there. And I was fortunate enough to be there with a guy who did not get tenure, was eccentric as hell, but was the forerunner of what we would now call molecular biology, as well as the guy I had met at the program in biochemistry in the summer. His name was Ed Ledbetter. He was a microbiologist. And the other fellow's name was Walter Godshaw. And Walter was interested in the initiation of translation in vitro, and provided what I thought was an excellent education. In fact, graduate school in Rochester was worthless, to be honest. I didn't get out as fast as I could. The graduate program was pathetic. But we'll get into that in a minute. I learned most of what I needed in the time at Amherst.
Were you doing research in that?
Yes. In the summers, I returned as an instructor to this program in biochemistry. The NSF sponsored thing. Instead of being a student, you're an instructor, so you taught. And that's how I met people like Peter Alvar and Stuart Schumann. They were coming through as students. Okay, so yes, we were interested in the metabolism of amines. These are compounds that are around us all the time. And the director of the program had a particular interest, and he gave us each a different amine, and we were to understand its degradative pathway by microorganisms. Okay, fine. It was good. It was good experience. You have to make inroads based on lab data and so forth. Okay, so that was freshman summer and sophomore summer. You'll notice I never went home. I was either in college or at home. I really didn't have much to do with any of those clients. Junior year, I was fortunate in the sense that the biology department could nominate one person to go to the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. And that was the first of what I would consider to be four real breaks. We've already talked about one. That was Westinghouse getting into Amherst. This is the second. The Marine Biological Laboratory has a physiology course. So in 1974, I was in taking that course, and that's where I met Gerald Weissman, who I would consider to be an important intellectual force. That's why I'm here, basically. I mean, he helped. We'll talk about that, but he knows who I am. He knows who many of us are, I think. Certainly pushes the advisory committee for folks when they don't look quite so good on paper. But the course was fantastic. It broadened out what I would consider to be a reasonable education, but filled in the gaps that Amherst College couldn't fill in. And it provided an access to an scientific intellectual climate that is really spectacular. I don't know whether you've ever been to Woods Hole in the summer, but it's just, people descend from Boston and New Haven and set up housekeeping, and there's the intellectual discourse there in the friendly environment of the sciences and sand and so forth is really good. But more importantly, Weissman has an intellectual a cognitive function level which I hadn't run into before. Lots of folks there were good protein chemists, or they were good nucleotide chemists, but Jerry was the only one who could talk about impressionistic art or 19th century British literature in the same sentence. And that kind of stimulation to get into intellectual life I found to be very powerful. Okay, so he was kind enough to invite me back to work in his laboratory the next summer. So I went back for a second summer at the MBO. And I don't know whether you want to know about the scientific things going on at the same time. That's what's in the CV. You'll see two papers there that were very early, in 75 and 76 or something like that, both due to Jerry. Jerry's very productive and converts things into text very quickly. And one of the papers is actually still good, believe it or not. I think it's interesting. One in PNAS by Weissman et al. The one looking at immunoglobulin-coated liposomes basically is a technique for transferring enzymes. These days...
How did you feel about getting into print like that?
Oh, that's always a spectacular feeling, because that paper was cited in Scientific American. I will never forget the day that it came out. And people at Amherst College came up to me and said, did you know your name was in Scientific American? It was kind of a commentary on science that was happening, sort of like the beginning of Science Magazine has a This Week in Science. Well, Scientific American has Science for the Common Citizen or something. They mentioned this paper. And it was what we would call it now is gene therapy, and it got a lot of press. I wish if this had been 20 years later, Jerry could have had a patent on this, and it could have been worth a fortune. But we weren't thinking like there's a transition that's going on. We just weren't thinking biotechnology in the early 70s. The idea of being able to put enzymes back into cells that are deficient in that particular enzyme is the basis for a lot of biotechnology now. Using liposomes, Jerry has a whole company on liposomes now. Anyway, I applied to Rochester. I applied to lots of medical schools and some combined degree programs. I did write a thesis at Amherst College, I should tell you that. I don't think it's on there. It was basically having to do with the synthesis of opsin in vitro, opsin, O-P-S-I-N. It's the major protein component of the visual pigment present in rods and cones. We were interested in this protein as a model for membrane protein assembly in vitro. This was the major a major interest of this guy, Walter Gottschall, and we did a lot of in vitro protein synthesis. Okay, so I graduated from Amherst College, applied to medical schools in MD-PhD programs, and the only MD-PhD program that I got into was Rochester. And I did get into some other medical schools. But Rochester, the difference between an MSTP program and medical school is dramatic when it comes to funding. One, you go for free. The tuition is covered on for both graduate programs. The other, you'd have to find private resources. And since I wasn't at the time really speaking to anybody, I felt it was appropriate to cover my own expenses. So I packed up for 6 snowy winters in Rochester, New York.
What's MSTP?
Medical Scientist Training Program. Okay. The NIH has, I think, 15 institutions in the United States that fund these combined degree programs.
Why can you say a little bit more about motivations to get the MD and PhD?
I'll be very honest, since this is a frank interview. An MD is job security. It is a broad education. The problem with graduate education is it's very limiting. Medical school is a tremendous exposure to the human condition. You get things, psychiatry, pediatrics, OB, that you just would never encounter in graduate school. It's the best continuation of a Renaissance graduate education that I can think of.
Had you worked that out for yourself, or was someone advising you?
Oh, no. No one advises me. I would say there are people who I talk to, but everything... I'm responsible for the major decisions. There really wasn't. I'm trying to remember. There may have been some subtle thoughts, but most people at Amherst go to business school, law school, medical school, or into education programs. There are very few going to direct graduate school. But I think had I been interested in that, I could have done that. But I just was more interested in continuing to broaden a bit. And realizing that you could do both graduate programs, come up with at least a marketable degree, plus if you had any talent for professional research, you could then continue.
Did you change?
No, I don't think it's time.
Oh. Okay.
Is this the sort of stuff you want to hear?
Yes, yeah, yeah, it's fine. Fine. It's okay. Fine. You said Rochester wasn't too good as an experience.
Well, personally, scientifically, I would say we're disasters. Personally, it was a disaster. scientifically, I would say that the medical school is excellent. It's a very card-carrying, traditional, very traditional medical school, in the sense that one does 2 full years of basic sciences with grades and so forth, and then one does the clinical years. It is a very pleasant place to do medical school. You're not going to get shot in Rochester. It's a lovely place to be entrenched, because your life is very easy. There are no problems. It's a city dominated by Kodak, which is a very conservative company, and that tenor tends to reflect in all aspects of the city's life. Okay, fine. Medical school is medical school. It's like doing plumbing. It's a trade school degree. They're pretty much the same everywhere. The graduate education, I would say, many chairs were missing. Put it this way, I have more money now than my entire department did as a graduate student in micro. I was formerly a graduate student in micro. After doing the first 2 years, I then went into the laboratory for 2 years and was working with a guy by the name of Jim Wilhelm, who was formerly in microbiology, but was again what we would call a molecular biologist now. We were interested in the same kinds of things I was doing as an undergrad, which greatly facilitated the rate at which I could get things done. But Jim was a nice guy, but he had what I would consider to be a reasonably weak personality, and he was eventually, about the time I was leaving, he didn't get tenure, and his marriage split up, and he ended up in Philadelphia. working for a company. It was clear to me that he was not a major scientific mind. The nice thing about having worked with Weissman is I knew where I had to go. I knew what first-class science was, what first-class intellectual thinking was, and this wasn't it. So I tried to get through as fast as I could and get back to something else. Okay, I came to Rochester single after having known an interesting woman in college. Her name was Pat Gallagher. Pat was a very smart lady who went to Georgetown Law School, where she was a star, and basically just missed being a Supreme Court clerk. Anyway, we were involved on and off again, and she was, so she thought, was interested enough to me to come to Rochester. She took a great job in one of the big law firms, and after, I think it was the first 2 years, she had basically established herself in Rochester, and I think the following year, my third year in Rochester, I'd have to remember exactly the dates, but we were married for about a year, I would say, when I was in my third year doing clerkships, and it turned out she was much more interested in some of the other more powerful attorneys. She was a aggressive Democrat, was an alternative Democratic National Convention, was very interested in politics, and I was a medical student trying to survive. And basically, we never saw one another, and my last year in Rochester, we basically separated, and it was remarkable. She said they have a computer on their firm, or their firm has a computer which spit out a separation agreement. She said she separated us in about 45 seconds. It was absolutely unbelievable.
Alternative, right?
On that note, yes. But in Patricia's defense, she was a smart lady who had established herself and basically had a reason to expect a bit more. I also, at that point, was convinced I could not stay in Rochester, and her legal situation was such that she really couldn't leave Rochester. She had established herself. Anyway, we separated basically in May or June, and a year later I was out of Rochester. It turned out she was an associate at that time. They did not promote her to partner. Interesting. And then she went to work for some judicial court judge, and I haven't actually spoken to her in almost 10 years. So she is subsequently remarried. I don't know whether she has any kids of her own, but at this point.
You did get a couple more publications in there somewhere.
Desperate. Talk about making something out of nothing. Oh my God. Yeah, basically, I took something that I thought was doable and made something out of it so that I could fulfill requirements for what they considered to be a PhD. I was underwhelmed. I think, parenthetically, when I got back to Boston, I had a chance to work in some first-class laboratories, which we can talk about. The difference between graduate education in Harvard and graduate education in Rochester is absolutely astounding. There is some truth to the fact that where you get your degree does make a difference in graduate education.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Okay. All right. Well, why don't I just came to Boston in 1981. Where I was a pathologist. I should actually tell you, that's an interesting story. I was very depressed when I left Rochester, applied to one pathology residency, actually two, Yale and the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is a Harvard affiliate, and applied as a postdoc to Gunter Blobel's laboratory at Rockefeller, and had all but accepted the postdoctoral position I was going to get out of medicine altogether, and actually went to look at the gorgeous apartments on the Upper East Side. It's just amazing, you know, the lovely places Rockefeller has. But anyway, Catran, chairman of the Department of Pathology at the Brigham, gave me a break and basically took me when no one else was really interested. And that's break number three, basically. Okay, so I came to be a pathologist, having never done any pathology. Thought it was probably good for my science, but boy, was I rudely awakened. Anyway, a year in pathology, and I basically could not handle that anymore. I needed a break, and was fortunate enough to run across a guy by the name of Jordan Pober, who was a junior faculty person at in pathology, who had worked in Jack Strominger's laboratory. And Jordan is brilliant. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. We can talk about him in terms of some politics. There are people here who... The politics in Boston is interesting. You could write a book on that alone. But Jordan got me into Jack's lab, and that really was very helpful. Jack is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. There's two big labs in Boston, one in biochemistry and molecular biology, and the other over in the Dana-Farber. And basically, I spent some time there, formally under the tutelage of Jordan, but basically working in Jack's lab doing molecular biology, Strominger. He is well known to lots. He's interested in the major histocompatibility complex and basically the molecular basis of immune responses. And Jordan was interested in vascular endothelial cells, and we just brought the two interests together. And the next set of papers have to do with my experience with both Jordan and in Jack's place for the most part. Alright, so I did that for 3 years and had a great time. It was at that point that I experienced the difference between the 7 or 8 years it takes to be a Harvard graduate, PhD graduate, and the 2 years it takes to be a Rochester graduate, and the quality of the publications, the list of publications one needs for graduation. Basically, I had a long postdoc to make up for the graduate experience that I didn't have. Mm-hmm. Okay, 3 years of what I would consider to be sort of molecular biology. There's a transition in the CV. I went basically from cytokines and MHC antigens on vascular cells to cloning growth factors. And basically, I didn't want to step on either Jack's toes or Jordan's toes, and made a transition into an area that I thought would be fundable. And it's proven to be so. And that's this vascular express, so-called platelet-derived growth factor. This is a mitogen that controls the behavior of smooth muscle cells. And the argument is very simple. If you take a blood vessel, the blood vessel is lined by endothelial cells. These are basically the gateway to the tissues. And these cells interact with both circulating blood elements as well as surrounding smooth muscle cells. If you injure those cells, they produce substances which are chemotactic for circulating blood leukocytes as well as smooth muscle cells. Such an injury, like hypertension or smoking, may damage the endothelial cell, cause it to release these growth factors and stimulate the proliferation of smooth muscle cells to form what you know as the atherosclerotic plaque. Right? At that time, heart, lung, and blood had very few molecular biologists. So I would consider, you know, my break number four was getting involved in the right place at the right time. I've had great luck with NIH funding. I have two R01s and part of a program project, which all have to do with this business of sort of molecular biology of the vasculature. I've not had, if you count the pew, I think I'm 6 for 6 or something in terms of grants. It's really been quite, I mean, I've been very fortunate. Anyway, my third year as a postdoc, I wrote the first of these R01s. And while that was off at study section in council, I went back to residency. And my goal in life is to run a pathology department. I want to be a chairman. I'll state that straight away, since most of my colleagues know it. To do that, you have to be certified by the American Board of Pathology. The second year of anatomic path was designed to accomplish the credentials one needs to be board certified. Anyway, so I did that. And promptly thereafter, I was fortunate, got a good priority score. I could immediately jump into a funded lab situation. All I had to do was find space, which is not trivial. Unfortunately, in Boston, there are lots of people with money. Space is the limiting commodity. And I had to elbow some people out of the way, some technicians who thought they were ruling the roost, and told the chair that, look, we have an R01, for heaven's sake, I'd like a little space to work on it. And he said, okay, fine. So I've got 400 square feet or thereabouts. Where I am still now, I don't have a lot of space. In fact, my dollars per square foot are staggering, I think. It's just amazing. Anyway, so I fulfilled pathology criteria, eventually passed the anatomic pathology boards on card-carrying pathologists, and then basically have been doing research on these vascular things. All right, where else?
Can we go back and compare the graduate school's style of research? Is it in the differences? What really are they when you spell them all out?
I'll give you a feeling. All right. Basically, the folks in Boston have larger space. They have generally more people, usually fewer technicians, more graduate students and postdocs. If you go to Rochester on a weekend, you'll never find anyone in the laboratory. If you go there at night, you'll never find anyone there at night. I hope you're not from Rochester.
No. I just can't imagine a lab with nobody at night.
Well, it's the philosophy of the town. It's a very stable, home-oriented, traditional kind of family life. It's a job. It is not an obsession, and that's the difference. You know, I'm obsessed. I'm there before 6, and I'm there till 8 every night. Okay, I go through spouses like other people go through cars, you know. It is a level of intensity that is different. You have it in the Boston labs. People from all over the world have left their lives and have come to work. They work all hours of the day and night. A laboratory that works 24 hours a day is generally doing interesting things. You have shifts. You have good ideas, and you have people pursuing those ideas, and that's what was missing in Rochester. And that was very clear to me after having been at Woods Hole. Woods Hole, there's an intellectual fervor that's present that is not present in Rochester. At the time I was there, in the areas that I was exposed to, I have to be qualified, I'm saying. at Harvard, MIT, either side of the river. It's there. It's there all the time. You go, you know, my lab, basically, I'm in there before 6, and I'm there till 8. I have plenty of people that work till 2 in the morning, so there's a downtime of only a few hours when someone's not around. Things are going, I think, on a seven-day calendar week. Maybe that's enough of that tirade. Intensity, I would say, to put in a single word.
Now, who in... you can go back to mentors. How does... is Jerry Wiseman in here or not? In this piece of the story? Or?
Yeah. No, at this point, I think I have... basically, I'm entrenched in Boston. I really didn't have any contact, much contact with Jerry. In fact, he only visited Rochester once to give a seminar, and that told me something. No, Jerry was someone who came in at a time when I basically was impressionable, and he had a sense of how science should be done, how intellectual life should be pursued, and what he calls the leisure of the theory class, which I find a statement that's particularly good. How one spends one's time when one is an academic, so you have to learn. You can learn how to do science. You can learn how to write manuscripts. But to think about intellectual history is something that you need to live to some extent. And he's good at it. He's very smart. But I didn't have much contact with him at this point. I was developing the tools to be a professional scientist, but a professional molecular person in Cambridge, and doing this pathology stuff to a very pragmatic end.
Can you say a little bit more around the politics of that?
All right, let's do some politics, since you have people here that I'd love to talk about. Let's talk about the politics in the vascular group in Boston, because there's a guy here who you interviewed last year who's involved in this. Okay. Basically, I came and worked with this guy. He came to Boston, did pathology, and went off into the vascular group. Pathology at the Brigham, if I can be a bit boastful here, is probably the best pathology department in the United States. Ramsey Cattran, the chairman, wrote the textbook which all the medical students used. It's Cattran somebody. Pathologic Basis of Disease. Very powerful guy. Has a long tradition of vascular biology. He has a... science is a very feudal system in Boston, and Ramsey's the king. The king had princess, knight, squire, you know. Underneath Ramsey is Michael Gimbroni. Michael Gimbroni is one of the first people to culture in the field of the cells, and director of the vascular division. Jordan was a junior faculty member in that division, and basically was the first person to treat endothelial cells, these vascular lining cells, with cytokines, specifically gamma interferon. That observation was the stimulus which catalyzed Gimbroni's return to scientific credibility. His Harvard tenure decision was really hanging in the balance. Jordan wrote a series of manuscripts with Michael, on which Michael did basically nothing. I'm going to get myself into trouble since Gimbroni is nominated for the chair of Harvard Pathology. Anyway, Michael was tenured. Jordan basically developed this technology of putting inflammatory mediators onto endothelial cells and causing them to do things. Enter another Pew scholar, Mike Bevilacqua. Michael was the first person to dump IL-1 on endothelial cells and study leukocyte adhesion. I was basically peripherally involved, so I can kind of watch all of this stuff, which I think would perhaps be useful to you. Michael proceeded to observe that interleukin-1 has effects on endothelial cells, which is important in terms of the endothelial cell's ability to stimulate blood coagulation as well as to bind leukocytes. Why does anybody care? Anybody cares because major drug companies are interested in the anti-inflammatory drugs that could come out of the molecules that mediate these events. Okay, a major battle blew up monoclonals were raised. One of those monoclonals was raised by a woman, Donna Mendrick, who is lost in all of this. Katran, Cimbroni, Bevilacqua, and Polder have all written many manuscripts and received multiple prizes for monoclonal made by Donna Mendrick. Okay. Anyway, this monoclonal basically defined the molecules that mediate leukocyte adhesion and blocked it. That monoclonal was taken to Brian Seed's laboratory. All right, Brian Seed's brilliant, eccentric as hell. I could tell you Brian Seed stories that would absolutely snap your socks, but Brian is one of the world's best molecular biologists right now. He developed an expression cloning strategy. He actually cloned this entity called ELAM, endothelial leukocyte adhesion molecule. At this point, Polder wanted a piece of this action. Cimbroni and Bevilacqua were not going to provide it to him. Jordan was forced to move out of the division into his own separate little area. He is subsequently leaving. Vince Marchese, chair of pathology at Yale, is setting up a Howard Hughes Institute, a so-called molecular medicine institute. And there will be a vascular division in that institute. Jordan is going to chair that as of July. He's basically leaving Boston because of this. Okay, big splash in science. Big article, you know, the molecular mechanism of adhesions are defined. Lots of companies wanted in. One company came to Bevilacqua offering him $10 million, $10 to $20 million to start up a company. Cimbroni blocked that, blocked the acquisition of those funds. Basically, Michael Bevilacqua, Michael Cimbroni, then had a tremendous flare-up. Michael is now struggling to stay alive. He's had one NIH grant turned down and basically has not written another one. He and I collaborated. You may notice there's one manuscript on there. He and I are reasonably good friends. That's why I'm telling you this. Brian did the CD and I did the gene. All right, to look at its structure. I'm very interested in transcriptional regulatory mechanisms. We define the promoter. But because of this interest, I'm trying to give you, and this is going to, I don't know whether I should have said all this, but it's very interesting because these molecules have tremendous commercial value and the politics has determined to some extent what's happened. Anyway, Michael at the moment is definitely leaving the Brigham because of Cimbroni's political power over this issue of the venture capital funds. They're just, you know, they can't seem to stand having one another in the same department. Okay, so Michael, basically Cimbroni, went from Pover to Bevilacqua and is now moving on, trying to play another person, this guy Myron Cebulski, who's another leukocyte adhesion person, into this whole thing. He's trying to show, basically, that Michael's, Bevilacqua's success was due to Cimbroni's architecture and creative thought processes, when in fact that's definitely not true. Cebulski is interested in this stuff called, it's called astral ELAM. It's another leukocyte adhesion molecule that mediates the attachment of circulating monocytes. That's potentially the first step in atherosclerosis. Anyway, Myron is now in my lab cloning all this stuff. You know, I'm kind of the resident cloner, which is nice, but you know, you get the politics here. Jim, the sad part is, Bevilacqua raised a monoclonal against another antigen, which he called INCAM-110. Okay, that molecule turns out to be the same thing as this athero-ELAM. So Myron and Bevilacqua are at odds with one another because they independently kind of came across the same molecule doing two different things. All right, is that enough politics?
Was some sort of deal made with some other pharmaceutical company?
Michael was blocked from any kind of industrial fund acquisition by, I think it was Cimbroni, but I'm not.
So this was an old-fashioned ethos of science or something?
Well, Cimbroni wanted to set up his own vascular institute. He didn't want to have a junior person, this guy Bevilacqua, running some sort of institute. In the pathology department, there's really only room for one vascular institute, and he wanted to run it. Since that took place, this was all about a year ago, 6 months ago, Cimbroni has gotten us together, and we've tried to market our skills to various companies to recruit additional funds.
Is it easy to get their attention, the company's attention?
Oh, in this business, sure. Because of the possibility of developing these potentially valuable drugs. For example, if one has a heart attack, one of the things that causes damage to the myocardium is reperfusion injury. Polly's partner from the cubicle transverse the endothelial cell to the damaged tissue and basically engulf it. If one could block that process, one might diminish the infarct size. So there are several strategies that one could potentially employ, and the companies are obviously very enthusiastic about developing these reagents, and in fact are proceeding independently. There are a number of companies that are well along the way of developing soluble forms of these molecules. The idea is very simple. Basically, what you would do is take a soluble form of a leukocyte adhesion molecule and inject it into your patient that you're delivering something which disrupts a blood clot in a coronary vessel, for example. And that way you would reperfuse the damaged area, but you wouldn't get the tremendous tissue destruction.
Are these biotech companies or mm-hmm. traditional pharmaceutical or what?
Biotech, for the most part. When I mean a big company, I would say like Genentech, for us, would be a big company. We deal or have dealt with Genetics Institute and Biogen for the most part. Most of the bigger companies can develop their own stuff in-house. The smaller companies generally have to recruit or, buy vascular expertise. Or at least that's Stromboni's thought.
Can we just push out on the biotech aspects for a while? How's that scene changed, and what can
you... Well, it's a tremendous transition. I would say 10 years ago, people who weren't in the industry are viewed as second class. Folks who couldn't do anything in academics. Now you've got great people out in companies. There's a lot of interplay. Many of us have submitted things to our technology transfer office for review for patents. Every time I clone something, I call them and ask, is this something the hospital is interested in? And if you have something that's immediately potentially marketable, then obviously they're much more excited. I know I'm on one patent application. I may be on more, I don't know. Since we're so encumbered by Harvard, by the Brigham, we'll never see anything out of these. It's almost another layer of bureaucracy these days we have to go through. But the companies certainly are, because the hospital could transfer rights to some of these things to the companies. And it would save them a lot of developmental time. But no, we do battle with the companies in terms of scientific stuff all the time.
Is all of this affecting the people's research focus in any discernible way?
Not in my area per se. Not in what I'm funded to do, namely endothelial growth factors. I would say what someone like Bevilacqua was funded to do. Sure, now they're blowing them out of the water. There's so much interest. They're making steps with resources that he can't hope to compete with. My interests, fortuitously, are not those that a company would be concerned about. It's very interesting, though. We've recently stumbled across the fact that neurons have growth factors, and the immediate interest for them is nerve regeneration. And went to the technology transfer office, and they, of course, were interested for a while and wanted us to demonstrate that, in fact, this growth factor does stimulate neuronal growth or prolong growth in culture, or in fact stimulates proliferation of neurons, something interesting like that. And the companies were certainly interested. But for the most part, what I do, growth factor research, the companies all have their own growth factors by now. 5 years ago, when we were the only ones with growth factor clones, they hadn't gotten there yet. They were still thinking about it. Recombinant growth factors was really beyond them. Growth factors and wound healing was their major interest. I would say the only company-like research I'm doing right now is looking at the role of PDGF, platelet-derived growth factor, in the regeneration of gastric epithelium in ulcers. The idea is very simple. If we can show that if one has or induces in an animal model an ulcer, we add growth factor, and the growth factor stimulates re-epithelialization of that ulcer, then what you would do is you'd give a person this growth factor with an H2 antagonist, H2 receptor antagonist, and you might get tremendous re-epithelialization, and the ulcers would heal quicker. So that's really the only commercial interest. But I try and stay away from things I know companies are doing, because you cannot compete with the kind of resources that they have. They're just, they're very good. Similarly, I don't try to do things that I know big molecular biology groups are doing, because you just cannot compete with 40 postdocs in a well-funded army, basically. They have too much talent, too many resources to really be competitive.
Who are, in your particular area, where are those big?
Oh, the sharks? Oh, well, you know, my motto is, if you swim with sharks, don't bleed. The sharks in molecular biology in Boston are pretty easy to find. In our building, Phil Leader is definitely a powerful guy. He's nominated for the presidency of Harvard. David Baltimore over across the river, taking the presidency of Rockefeller. Phil Sharp should have taken the presidency of MIT and did not. I don't know why. Harvey Lodish, one of the guys you know, and certainly would watch out. Stuart Orkin, a Harvard Hughes investigator at Children's Hospital. These are people which have large labs, well-funded, members of the National Academy, substantial resources. You really want to stay away from people who are at the peak of their career. Their intellectual skills are high. And you just have to be careful. You don't want to tread on their toes, because they are... It's like swimming with sharks. You don't make any mistakes, because they will chew you up.
How does that happen operationally?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's easy. Single phone call. Don't fund this grant, or they get papers to review. Don't publish this paper. I've seen, Strominger is a member of the National Academy. He was called for some one of the people in his laboratory a recommendation. He said the guy was terrible. That ended that job. Someone could finish my career in Boston with a couple of phone calls to the right people. These are very major players that you really need to be very careful with. Yes, a certain amount of work is going to always overcome that, but the politics being what it is in the feudal system, there's not much that a squire or a knight can do when the king says, I don't like you, I want you out.
Do you think everyone's very much aware of this? Are all the knights and squires aware of it?
If they want to survive. I mean, I've been there for 10 years. You start as a resident, you end up almost an associate professor. To survive is tough.
What's the other side of the coin? What you have to deliver things as well as avoid them.
Oh, you have to produce. If you don't produce, you're out. You have to maintain political ties. If you don't, you're out. The really gifted people are able to be incredibly productive. And if they can do so in a way that doesn't step on someone's toes, they are do very well. You think about people who have been tenured at Harvard in less than, say, 6 years or less, and there aren't very many. Those are real stars. Doug Melton, who's over in biochemistry and molecular biology, is a world-class developmental biologist. Did something in a department where there is no one like them. Is dominating the field.
I'll turn it over.
rest of us try and hide a bit. The advantage to a clinical department is one's not quite under the same pressure for a tenure decision that you're under in the basic science departments.
Because you can run on, can you run on indefinitely without tenure, or how does it work?
Well, no, not really. There's a lot more flexibility.
Just more years?
Yeah. Basically, there is at least 6 years after they make you an associate professor, and that can take a while. So you can easily be unemployed at 50. No, I would like to hang out in Boston and either see what happens or take a departmental chair and a tenured position at the same time. The advantage, you know, why do all that administrative stuff? The reason is the clinical revenues. The people with power these days have departments that generate clinical revenues. And you can take those revenues. Besides paying, compensating people well, you can develop scientific programs and support junior people.
And you really would have, as chair, a lot of discretion to generate.
Absolutely.
And
under the current health payback situation, which of course is subject to change, but yeah, those revenues basically come back to the department and the chair can allocate them as he sees fit. That's the difference, for example, between Catran's position as chair of pathology at the Brigham, or the chair of pathology at NGH, for example, and the chair of pathology at Harvard. No clinical revenues, all administrative. It's a pain in the ass. Yes, you have space, but you don't have the same kind of funds.
Does that mean the Harvard department, in fact, gets less prestigious people, or is there enough just name to...
Well, no. I mean, there are people who for example, were well-established people who have turned down the chair at Harvard of pathology because of that problem. They're better off being in a clinical context, or they don't want to move to Boston and deal with all the political nightmares. It's interesting. The chair has been turned down several times. I'm trying to think whether any, I don't think any of the national cabinet, or the advisory board's turned it down. Bill Paul may have been asked, I don't know. The current chair is Baruch Benassareff, and he's resigned the position as chair of pathology to he had two positions, chair of pathology and director of research at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's relinquished the former, and the search committee was formed, and so on and so forth.
Let me go back into inside your career, if we may, for a little while. And you're 86. You're setting up your own lab, essentially. Is that right?
Right.
How has that lab grown and changed over time? What is it now? What do you want it to be? Can you talk about the realities?
Well, the reality, I had, as I mentioned, sort of elbow the technicians out of there. They're tenured technicians, basically, who could be a pain in the ass. But I didn't get any startup funds because the chair, Ramsey's a brilliant guy. He was born in Lebanon, speaks five languages. He knew that if I had a big R1, I can get anything I needed, so he wasn't going to give me much money. So I had to build it up. Every wastebasket, every chair, we had to purchase. It cost us a fair amount of time. But it is now... we've expanded a little bit, but started with one technician, and we're still a very small group. There's no graduate program in pathology. I depend on residents to try and recruit, and I've had some success with residents. For example, Art Mendoza was a GYN pathologist who wanted to do some things, learn a little science. He came in the lab and we tried to help him out. Current postdoc is Joachim Fries. He's an interesting story. He was basically fired from his first postdoc, which was renal pathology, and then went to this Harvard School of Public Health with Diane Wirth, where he was also fired. And he was on his way back to Germany, but he's very loud, he's very aggressive. But he's kind of manic depressive. When he's manic, he's incredibly good. So I figured, well, he's better than nothing. And recruiting people is very difficult. And he's turned out to be quite good.
Difficult, yes.
Well, it's difficult because why come to Boston and work with me when you can work with Phil Leader or David Baltimore or people who are more well-known? And we don't have a graduate program. The high-powered residents, the MD PhDs, who have been well-trained, are candidates for the biggest labs in the city, so they wouldn't be interested in someone like me. Now, in contrast, if I were sitting in Rochester, I'd be mocked. I can tell you. There are enough interesting things going on in the lab for people to join. It's just that in Boston you have such a wealth of such powerful people that the junior people can really struggle. I would say that's my biggest complaint, difficulty, is getting people into the laboratory. I've been dependent on Jim Brony, for example, to have folks available to help fill the lab and do interesting things, like this guy, Myron Cebulski. Wanted to learn molecular biology, was a good cell biologist, and is now cloning an interesting molecule.
In terms of funding the lab and...
Okay, funding the lab, as I mentioned, has been reasonably good. I've been very lucky. I wrote an R01 when I was a second-year resident, which was funded. And basically it was used to start up the laboratory and fund a technician. I'm almost entirely on... My salary is derived entirely from grant support. That's minus about 7 or 8%, which I get from the autopsy service work that I get. So if I don't stay funded, I'm out the door. They wouldn't keep me. That's why I don't really worry about a tenure decision. Because nobody pays me anything. They don't pay me anything anyway. I do not have salary support.
Well, there are a lot of people around Boston in analogous position.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what, in a sense, makes it exciting. Even the more senior people are dependent on federal revenues for their salary support. They've gotten lazy, in a sense. They've been very lucky in terms of grant support. Usually been well funded. But times are changing, and even the more senior people are being cautious in their applications upon early and making sure they have duplicate funding vehicles, trying to cut back, not waste, because it has, for the last few years, have been very tough. Anyway, so I wrote 101. Then Mike Gimbroni is a powerful guy, has a $3 million a year program project. I contributed a part of that program project. And then this winter I wrote another R01, which, believe it or not, got a priority score of 0.9. It was unbelievable. It was just staggering. And the percentage was very good. So it was funded, but it wasn't funded at a level that I would have liked. Even though the study section approved it all, they were mandatory fixed cuts in what they could provide. So even if you get through the scientific review process, the start date can be postponed, or council can change the funding amounts because of this and that. So that's why the Pew funds are so incredibly valuable. The Pew funds supported Freeze. They paid his salary. Very valuable guy. And they supported another individual, Parvez Sultan, who is an undergraduate in the laboratory, who has been productive.
Why did Harvard nominate you for the Pew?
Oh, that's an interesting story. Harvard didn't nominate me. Okay, my year, Roger Brent was nominated by Harvard. Harvard, as you know, has a very interesting system because they have these different schools. There's the medical school, the School of Public Health, and the School of Arts and Sciences. And each of those nominates two, and then there's a Harvard-wide, some smoke-filled room somewhere, all of these big round-bottom folks, great, powerful types, sit and choose someone. And that year it was Roger Brent and somebody else, I think. And they're basically assured of any kind of junior faculty fellowship, whether it's Pew or Searle or this or that. It doesn't really matter. They generally get what they're nominated for. Okay, when the Pew changed, they went from, I think, 40 institutions to 80 institutions. The Brigham receives an ungodly amount of NIH funds. The Brigham is a little hospital. This hospital receives more than most of the academic communities in the rest of the country. It's staggering. I mean, pathology has $10 million, our pathology department, and medicine has $50 million in NIH. It's a lot. So the Brigham nominated some folks, and I was one of the Brigham nominees. I got canned by Harvard, and then the Brigham people picked me up. The interesting story about this was, my chair called me. He forgot. The application came back. It sat on his desk. He called me Saturday at 3 o'clock saying, I forgot your application has to be in New Haven by Monday at 5 p.m. So I drove in, you know, slammed the whole thing together. I had to drive the thing down there, and my car broke down on the way back. It was unbelievable. Anyway, it was very valuable. Think about the total number of hours spent putting it together over the funds and fees given in terms of dollars per hour. It was a good deal. I'm afraid I had to shoot my car, though. That never quite recovered.
Why, there must have been other possible candidates at Brigham. Why did they...
Well, who knows? That was the first year it had jumped from 40 to 80, and I get the feeling that the only reason I was nominated is that they knew, some of the folks knew who I was, and if the Brigham hadn't nominated someone because they fouled up logistically, they'd look bad, and I was available. I really, this was a last-minute deal. This was not a logical progression. This was not the kind of organized committee that they now have. It's a much bigger deal.
But how have you used those funds, in fact?
Okay. Odds and ends, equipment, I would say mostly salary support. Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm most desperate for is people, and I try and recruit it. For example, this guy Freeze wants a green card. The few funds will be used to support the green card. Let's see. Mostly odds and ends, I think. Things that we've run out of money on our R1. I haven't used it in any logical way. It's mostly to fill in. I have about $50,000 left, which I'm going to use to sort of as venture capital.
Did your getting the Pew have a feedback effect on people's perception of you? Brigham and
no, not at the Brigham. They're too many good people. And there are people, you know, that are just so far above you. As I said, I'm just a maybe. I used to say I was a squire. I don't know, maybe I'm getting a little old to be a squire, but there's people so far above you in the academics, people, Nobel laureates, I mean, members of the National Academy all over the place. There are so many folks getting these kinds of prizes and awards that no one pays much attention, to be honest. It's almost embarrassing if you don't get them. You live just the reverse. And that's probably unfortunate. But, you know, for example, there's me, Charlie Sirhan, Jim Anderson. I mean, and all these things come up here and there, and there are plenty of people who, what's his name? The guy with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is 40, he was elected in the National Academy of Sciences. Like, you know, the Pew is nice, but there are things that are quite high, and people won the Nobel Prize in Boston. And, you know, people don't really care about the Pew. I mean, enough junior faculty positions that people that are doing interesting things. We appreciate it, don't. But you just have to appreciate that there are a lot of very good people, and all of whom are requiring this or that. And, you know, even in our department, we have two marquee people, Bevilacqua, myself. Bill Mueller was also in the same division, and it holds both a Pew and a RJR Nabisco. I mean, it's great. I come here and I see all my friends. It's fantastic. It's become a little incestuous, but they're good people.
In terms of... Can you talk a little bit about two different things? One is your research agenda, and the other is your career agenda.
Okay. Well, all right. Research agenda, I would say, could best be described as delineating endothelial transcriptional control mechanisms. We've been trying to define what makes an endothelial cell an endothelial cell. Are there lineage-specific gene products that determine a cell to become an endothelial cell, the same way, for example, myodine determines that a skeletal muscle cell becomes a skeletal muscle cell. We're also interested in the tissue-specific as well as ubiquitous factors involved in the regulation of important endothelial genes, growth factor genes, cell surface adhesion molecule genes, understanding what role those factors play in pathologic responses that the endothelial cell might be involved in. Basically apply the tools of molecular biology to the endothelial cell. Okay, I'm gonna, I could give you a more detailed summary, but that's pretty much it. In terms of career agenda, I would say I would like to be productive, to do interesting things. There is a movement in the lab into developmental molecular biology. We began by looking at expression of growth factor genes in developing human embryos, and we're very interested in the mechanisms by which developmental malformations occur. With two GYN postdocs in the lab, this is all unfunded. In fact, some of the Pew funds are used to support these kinds of things. We're trying to understand why we have two arms and two legs, and what happens when we don't. And we're hoping that we can tie together growth factor gene expression and the transcriptional control of some of the so-called helix turn helix or helix loop helix DNA binding proteins. Put simply, these DNA binding proteins will tell a cell where it is, and the growth factor genes will tell it to move or to divide. And we're hoping that if we can understand that process, we'll have some idea why cells move anomalously and generate a child without an arm, for example, or other larger malformations. The nice thing about being on the autopsy service is you see a lot of dysmorphic, you see a lot of pathology in general. You see a lot of, the brain does 10,000 deliveries a year and lots of things don't go right. So we see a lot of dysmorphic events. And we're in a unique situation to combine the tools of molecular biology to study normal as well as abnormal development. That's all unfunded. I don't think I could get it funded yet. But we're very excited by that. In fact, one of the guys coming to the lab, Andy Niche, will pursue just that. And two of the guys, part-time, Ray Redline, who was writing a paper, I don't know whether it's on there, maybe at the very end, describing a homeobox gene, and Art Mendoza basically had an abstract describing expression of PDGF in human embryos. All of that is kind of an undercurrent. That's not what we're funded to do. That's not where our real strength is, but it's something that I'm intellectually excited about. Okay, long term, as I said, I want to be chairman. I think it's possible there are a couple of precedents where people can run departments, maintain good clinical services, and still run first-rate research labs.
Why do you want to do all those things?
I enjoy it. There's nothing I like more than being involved with interesting ideas. It is an obsession. It is a level of intensity that I like. And as Katran put it, he wants residents who would rather write papers than go home and sleep with their wives. And that's generally my philosophy. He actually said that in a meeting. I couldn't believe it. But it basically sums up the philosophy. Women come and go. But the ideas are there. And you know, 20 years ago, we were thinking about some of the same processes. It's really funny to look at some of these older folks that you thought about Harvey Lotus, for example, been around a while, and you read their textbooks, and you see how the field evolves. And that contribution is substantial and I think is invaluable. We're at the right place with the right training to make a major difference in terms of intellectual history from the latter part of the 20th century. And I find that to everything else is secondary.
The way you just formulated it sounds like a very masculine grouping.
Science is a very masculine kind of job. The big people are very aggressive. And there are people who I tell you stories about, but I think then I would be treading on liberties that I really shouldn't take. But that's not to say that there aren't good female scientists. There are some in Boston that are really superb. And when they're at that level, there are colleagues, there's no question. When they have that same intensity, science is an equal opportunity. When you do it right, what I don't like is when it's not done right. I think women have a very difficult job today. Trying to maintain domestic harmony, trying to have a family, it is a tremendous burden. And the women that I know who are very smart, smarter than I am, are having a tough time trying to do both. And I would say that is probably the greatest, one of the greatest challenges to pull that off well, that I can think of.
Quite a number of female Pew scholars now. Are they running as strongly as the men? Can you?
Well, you ask yourself, how many people are world-class scientists? How many people have a national reputation? And you can think of some, everyone has their own prejudice, but you do have some women. Pamela Bjorkman, for example, is a nationally known person. But everyone goes through ups and downs. This is a very difficult time for most people. They're trying to make decisions about their personal life. They're trying to make decisions about how they're going to balance their careers with their family life. Some of that, I think, depends on where you are and what is demanded of you by circumstances that are outside of your control. But it's difficult. Mark Davis, for example, Frank Constantini, for example, these are people who were recognized pretty much throughout the scientific community for contributions. Within the Pew program. Mike Benoit is another who is well established. I'm trying to think of people who I've read in Science Times. That's my general. If you've been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in the Science Times, you've made it. I think those guys classify. I'm trying to think of people in the London Times. That's also a good one. If you've made it to the London Times, you're definitely doing well. So I think that's really a point-by-point or case-by-case situation. And when a woman is not doing well, my first question is why. And usually she's taken some time to have a family, and there's just no way. You know, I've done pediatrics. I mean, there's just no way you can maintain the same kind of intensity and still take care of the kid. And then my colleagues that are successful are A, very smart, and B, they have money. Because usually they have living help. They have a spouse who is making a lot of money, and that kind of support, financial as well as just the day-to-day handling of kids, allows them to spend the time necessary to really maintain themselves there. But the people that try and do it alone, you know, normal moms trying to make keep their kid in daycare, it just is tough. It's tough.
You yourself are still putting in a very large number of hours, isn't
it? Right. Yeah, I'm crazy. There's no question. I don't think most people wouldn't do what I do, but I it's pragmatic in a sense. I live on the south shore of Boston in a very lovely seacoast town. To beat the traffic, I come in very early, and it gives me a couple of hours before the troops roll in, and I stay late both pragmatically because they're there as well as to miss the traffic.
Do you expect to still be crazy in 10 years' time?
If the science is good, I'd get depressed. The question is, am I going to be... I've remarried since then, and am I going to go through yet another spouse?
I don't know. This is just second. Line.
This is second, yeah. Which is marginal. There is a price one has to pay for all of this, and I would say that may be part of it. Plus, I don't know about you, I tend to be much more productive when I am hungry, when I am less happy.
Do you think what you're seeing in your own life, you think that really has its analogues pretty much in the other Pew scholars and the rest of the...
No, we were actually talking about that. There are people who really are trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, especially the women. You know, that's just very clear that they are trying to balance their lives. And you can sit back and look, and you know the science is suffering for it. But that's fine. There has to be some moderation. I would say it's very reasonable. As a department chairman, I have to be careful that I cannot let my own feelings. You have to encourage stability. The last thing you want is a bunch of people who aren't stable. You have to be very supportive of family structures, because most people do very well in that kind of thing. And you need that to run a political department. I think that's true here. Most people
But not all. Most people tend to do better when they're supported, when their family life is intact. But it is hard. It is hard. They feel stressed because they see some of us who are still crazy. They have my postdocs and the more senior people have all gotten beyond that. Or they have had traditional marriages where they haven't had to worry about what the woman is going to do.
Let's go to a different area, if we may, and it's to do with the impact of technology, instrumentation, big science, all that sort of stuff. Can you?
Okay.
Is everything changing or what?
Oh yeah, there's no question. The rich get richer, the big groups move faster. Companies are in areas where they've determined to go, are like armies. Once you get an army moving in the right direction, they'll just step over anything. The trick is to know where the army's going, either get there before they do, or to stay out of their way. By armies, I mean big laboratories. Senior investigators at the Hughes Institute or members of the National Academy of Sciences. People with more than 10 postdoctoral fellows, or that many-ish postgraduate students, or big labs. With budgets of millions of dollars a year. You don't want to compete with them. And because of their productivity, it's easier for them to get additional funds, revenues. Okay, technology, I would say, has made our job, well, it's changed the level of question that we can ask, but it certainly has been important. I'm not someone who's dependent on instrumentation. I don't need a mass spec like Charlie Sirhan, for example. I don't need a fax analyzer to sort fluorescent labeled cells. The kind of DNA sequence technology that's been developed, even since I was doing the business, has made it easier, but is still not automated to the point where it negates the value of cloning genes. Okay, and that's kind of the next step. A lot of us will begin to. Well, if the genome were sequenced, we'd be asking different questions than the questions that we're currently employed to pursue.
Does that project make sense?
I'm a tremendous supporter of that. The sequence information would be absolutely incredibly useful. I'd love to see the funds come from other sources besides NIH. You don't want to deprive people of one-on-one funds to support this. This is an industrial kind of application. It is a technology project, which I think is proceeding along the right directions to obtain basically a map, and then refine the map, and then as the sequence and the technology develops, to do bits and pieces of it. I actually thought at one point about writing a grant to the Human Genome Project because of our interest in some of these developmental control genes, which are generally clustered, but having published many thousands of nucleotides, I'm obviously very supportive of the acquisition of sequence data. So I'm definitely a biased observer.
Mm-hmm. I'll turn it over now. Oh, wait, I...
Question a little bit in left field. Do you have any political interests?
Well, I'm kind of a hybrid person. Obviously, I'm dependent on the good graces of the United States government. And you think about it, I've been receiving federal funds since I was in my teens. Obviously, that is a Democratic leaning. I would say I have certain very strong convictions. I am pro-choice, which is really removes you from the Republican camp in many respects, although I am not particularly religious. I guess that's too many points, but I would describe myself, I guess, as a fiscal Republican, in the sense I believe in the free sector economy and what it can do to support people. Although I'm to some extent a supporter of the concerns of many Democrats, which puts me in an awkward political situation. As a departmental chairman, I would say I'll have to be a Republican, since most of them are in fact Republicans. So you get older, you make more money, you tend to become a little more conservative. But because you're in an academic environment, you are really Democratic, especially in Boston. That's a long answer to a simple question.
Do you vote?
Yes. Issue by issue, really.
What about religion? Your parents were religious and practicing.
Well, it's an interesting story, actually. My father was Episcopalian, nothing interesting about him. My mother was actually part Jewish. And her father was basically died very young. He was actually a foreign national and left Europe because of the rise of Nazi Germany. He was a very smart guy, supposedly. Died, couldn't get a job, died in a rubber factory in Akron. I'm not religious. I have a father who was tortured to death, a sister who was basically dying a slow agonizing death. I'm a scientist. When you coined your first gene, you realize there's not much to this business that we're not going to be able to understand. That's a terrible thing to say, but when you build living things from inanimate molecules, assemble your first recombinant phage, yes, we're more complicated, but we're not. I'm not an atheist. I'd say I'm an agnostic. On a good day, usually an atheist.
Yeah, okay. Let me ask you.
Having been divorced once, the Catholic Church didn't want anything to do with me. My current spouse was Catholic, and was surprised when she found out that the poor kid couldn't get married because of the Catholic man in Boston. I still wonder what she's doing with me. I think she does too now.
Can you talk about pet peeves about science? What would you change in the scientific scene if you could?
By and large, I think the system is pretty good. The peer review system, since I've profited from it, has been very good to me. And I think you tend to be a little biased when you haven't had problems. You tend not to criticize the system. I know lots of folks who've had difficulty getting grants through for one reason or another, and that's usually the first thing off people's lips. They'll say, "Well, we've got to fix that." Well, it's better. It's not a great system, but it's the best one we've got. I think it's reasonable. Harvard has recently changed its position about the number of papers one needs for tenure. There are plenty of people, even in the Pew Scholars group, who have inordinate numbers of papers. I don't really concern myself with that because I'm a physician. The so-called publisher perish mentality is, what do I care? I'll go be a pathologist. The guy left my lab to make $160,000 a year. You know, to hell with this nonsense. You know, he didn't want to have to deal with grant writing and $40,000 a year salary. And that's his first year. That's how it will double if they take him as a partner. You know, he went into real pathology. And these days, the money is still there. It's not as striking as it used to be, but it's still there. Anyway, so I'm less concerned by the traditional academic structure than perhaps I should be. Many people in the Pew group are straight PhDs. They are facing tenure decisions. And I think those can be arbitrary. I think they can be highly politically motivated, and I've seen good people demand positions that I think they should likely have. On the other hand, it's a system. And the system basically is designed to protect people when they take positions that the institution doesn't support. So, I need to come up with five good papers. Harvard says, and the problem is you need five world-class papers, so they're not going to interest you at all. So, I think if you resign yourself to say you're going to have to leave at some point, it's a question of when, how much can you get out of the institution.
Do you think you're going to have to leave?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Too many good people. The people who stay really are world-class. The people who have created a field and dominated that field for a substantial period of time. Plus, as I mentioned, there's a lot of money in the pathology department chairmanships. Most of the senior people you have to bring on. I mean, the director of the hospital makes about $380,000 a year. Many of the clinical chiefs make more than that. It is a none too trivial financial consideration, I would say. I can run a laboratory and they'll pay me, I'll do it, kind of situation. There are other concerns. You could not afford today to send your kids to college at $100,000 a year, or $100,000 in education, $100,000 a kid on an academic summer. You just can't. And unless you inherit money or you're incredibly sage at investments, you're going to need some additional funds.
How do you expect to time your exit?
Well, there's a truism. There are good jobs at bad places and bad jobs at good places. The trick is to find a job that's right for you at a time when you're getting on. The chairmanships come and go, but for example, the Hopkins chair is open right now. It will be filled, I presume. It will not open again in my lifetime. The Yale chair was just filled by a good friend of mine, John Morrow. That will not come open again in my lifetime. So to a certain extent, you have to weigh the pros and cons of each position and make a decision. If it's a good department at a reasonable institution and they're willing to support you, then you're really obligated to go. Of course, there are all sorts of conflicting problems. If you have a spouse who's never going to have Boston, then you may have to compromise, but, or change spouses, which is often easier. Isn't that terrible? You know, like buses, there's always another one coming along. That's sexist. See what happens when you go to an all-male school? It was Amherst's all-male, and that was the last year where that was true. It was a terrible experience. Really, it wasn't a good thing.
A couple of things in closure. One is you've talked about being a chairman of a department somewhere in due course, but can you just say a little bit more about the sort of things you'd like to do if you indeed take that route?
Okay. Basically, I would perceive myself as continuing to be primary investigator with an NIH-sponsored laboratory, directing the instruction of postdoctoral fellows as well as graduate students. I would like to see a strong graduate program in experimental pathology, and I would like to be involved in training residents, establishing a training program for residents and fellows in anatomic pathology, providing the clinical services that pathology departments provide, namely diagnostic information. I think it is possible to do all of that. There are a couple of people in the country who can do it, but it is not a 8-hour day job. What I need to develop, it's interesting, I watch Katrina, he's a brilliant guy, he has all sorts of logistical skills, but he is has an ability to work with people, and that's something that I need to work on. Chairmanships are successful because of someone's skills as a politician, and those skills have to be practiced. You don't just pick them. I don't pick them up overnight.
Would you like to learn them?
Well, yeah, that's what this time period is for. I think I can do some science, at least enough to be in a pathology department. Maybe not a world class molecular genetics department, but I know enough to collaborate with the people to make things happen. To bring pathology out of the 18th century is a tremendous goldmine, a resource that is being overlooked. And the ability to create such a department, I think, and train people in 21st century pathology, I think would be valuable. It would be fun.
I have a much more mundane question than it goes to our interests in documenting the careers of Pew scholars. Do you routinely keep old correspondence, lab photographs, old research proposals, this sort of stuff?
Yes, I actually have two old notebooks. You know, the type of thesis binders that come apart, remember those?
Mm-hmm.
Back before the days of microfilm and fancy binders? Yeah, I basically put all that's interesting. And I actually try and have people sign reprints that I think are important so that we establish a certain contact. No, I agree with you. I think that's important because there's a lot to science, and this kind of catalog of publications is not what's most interesting.
Well, you've given a very interesting interview. Thank
well,
you.
Well, I hope. I hope. I hope I haven't done too much to embarrass myself.